Hello and welcome to the Club Lifestyle Podcast. My name is David Greenwalt. This podcast is part two of an interview I did with nationally recognized childhood eating and feeding expert, Ellen Satter. If you are a parent or have an influential role in a child's life, you will not want to miss a second of this part. I previously covered Ellen's impressive background and synopsis of her 40 years of experience on part one. So make sure you get part one to hear the complete interview. And now, I leave you with part two of my interview with Ellen Satter. So why, what did that do for the child, and what, why would you give that exercise to the parent to allow the child who has some, I'm getting just a little bit ahead of myself, but we'll clear this up. Why the child was had set it up. You'll do a much better job than I will.
Well, Leanne was 6 years old and an extremely frightened child relative to her eating. And of course, if you frighten a child that they're not going to get enough to eat, they're frightened about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And because that is so fundamental to life itself. Well, Leanne had been a big baby. And to her parents, that meant that being a big baby, especially since Leanne liked to eat, that she was going to be a fat grown-up. So
right.
They started to restrict her right away from the time she was born. And they kept it up until she was, well, I first met her when she was 4.5 years old, and I actually treated her mother on behalf of Leanne when Leanne was 6 years old. And so they restricted her, kept her weight down until she got to be a toddler. And then she became, you know, a pretty aggressive toddler, and she got the upper hand with eating. So she started to gain weight, and she gained and gained and gained. But it was still a battle. You know, it was always, is that all there is? Can I have more? I want a snack now. Can I have something to eat? You know, this, the way Leanne got fed was begging, and she just learned that nobody was going to feed her unless she put on a lot of pressure. And so, and the parents figured out that this wasn't working, and they were pretty tuned in to Leanne, and they could tell that she was miserable, and they certainly didn't like all the battles around food, and not only that, but Leanne just kept getting heavier and heavier. So they came to see me, and we set up a division of responsibility in feeding. And I said, Leanne is a frightened child. She's afraid that she's going to have to go hungry and spend her life experience. And so for her to get over this sort of desperate food-seeking thing that she does, you're going to have to reassure her in every way you can think of. You're going to have to say there's plenty of food. You're going to have to put the food on the table in dishes and make sure that at the end of the meal there's leftovers, because otherwise you can't tell if everybody's had enough to eat. And I said, always put bread on the table, because children can eat bread if all else fails, and Leanne can fill up on bread if she happens not to be particularly crazy about whatever meal you've planned. And so the mother said, and the mother goes pale, right?
Right.
And it was hard for her. She had to come and see me because she just didn't have the courage to do this on her own. And so she says, how much bread? And I held up my hand, and she just went pale.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, in the division of responsibility, you know, the parent is going to decide what, when, and where.
Yeah.
And you said the child's responsibility is how much and whether.
Exactly.
And you were going to push it to the max.
Exactly. Exactly. So she said, all right, a loaf of bread. So she did it. You know, she went out and planned her meals, that put her bread on. The next week she came back and she said, Brett, now this was the little brother, he's only eating bread. He's eating 2 or 3 slices of bread every night. I said, well, that's all right. He'll get over it.
Mm-hmm. There. Yawn. Yawn, stretch.
and he did. You know, that
the
newness wears off, and then he got interested in eating something else. But it was really hard for that mom to trust Leanne to eventually come to trust her, you know, because she really didn't think her parents were going to provide for her.
That's my question. That's the point I want you to drive home. What was the benefit of allowing this child? And you tell a story in the book, and you say that Leanne did start off eating a lot of bread,
mm-hmm.
and she pushed the envelope.
That's
she,
right.
She'd
a
eat,
lot of everything.
She'd eat like 6 inches of the bread or whatever. Or
mm-hmm.
What you know, whatever.
Right.
What did that How did that benefit the family? How did that benefit Leanne when the parents just sucked it up, stood their pail and let Leanne eat at first, 6 inches of bread, and then it went down. But how did Leanne benefit from that experience?
Well, Leanne had to be reassured that her parents really were going to provide for her. And, you don't reassure a 6-year-old. In fact, you don't even reassure a 50-year-old who's had to go hungry. The only way they're going to be sure that there's going to be enough to eat is by getting enough to eat. And so Leanne needed to reassure herself by eating, more than she was hungry for. And she kept asking her mom, I can have all I want, right? I can have as much as I want to eat. Now, she wasn't being naughty or provocative.
Mm-hmm.
She was just needing to sort of heal that part of herself that felt like she was going to have to go hungry. And once she began to heal that part and trust her parents that they really were going to let her eat as much as she wanted to eat, then she ever so gradually started to discover within herself her food regulators, her feelings of satisfaction, her feelings of, kind of losing interest in food. When you start to get full, the food doesn't taste as good as it did when you started the meal. Well, she began to notice those parts and to eat more commonly, the way a regular 6-year-old would eat, rather than, putting so much pressure on eating and then eating so much every time.
Let me tie this fear thing together for a minute, let you mm-hmm. do that. What happens, and to be a two-question thing, what happens when a child is routinely afraid of going hungry? And then two, what are the most common ways even good parents set their child up to be afraid? What happens when the child is afraid? And what are the most common things you see parents do, even just really, really good ones, where they may unknowingly or knowingly set their child up to be or to be living in fear? So what happens when the child's afraid that they are not going to eat on time or eat enough or eat in a structured way. Kind of clear that up, if you would. And then what are the things that parents are doing to their kids that create this fear?
Okay, now let me think about this a minute. This fear of going hungry, in Leanne's case, and in the case of many of the children I work with, isn't even a cognitive or a stated fear. It is a preverbal, sort of bone-deep, sort of life experience kind of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that a child, for instance, who's not allowed, an infant who's not allowed to eat as much as he's hungry for, will be very fussy, have a lot of trouble settling down. A hungry 2 or 3 months old will have more trouble connecting, that whole part when your babies were smiling and reaching out to you, and it was just so sweet. It just melted your bones.
Mm-hmm.
That child isn't going to be able to be that receptive and responsive because she's hungry. And then, when they get up to the point where they're insisting on doing things themselves, well, the hungry child is not going to be as uppity. Most children get up to around 8-10 months old and they don't want to be spoon-fed anymore. They want to do it themselves. Well, a hungry child won't take chances with the source of supply. They'll just let the parent eat them any way the parent wants to feed them because it'll be too scary to question or get oppositional in any way. So, and it goes on. At each stage in development, the hungry child just won't develop properly, won't do the kinds of things that you would expect a child to do at each stage in development. And so, there are some profound consequences to the child, but it all growing out of this fear of hunger and preoccupation with food, that they spend so much of their psychic energy Well, being hungry, and you know, if you're hungry, it's pretty difficult to think about anything else, and mm-hmm. that's what drives them. So getting beyond that level is very difficult for them.
That's great. Now, you state that as for the adult population, significant and sustained weight loss is virtually non-existent, unquote. How mm-hmm. would you respond to the people listening and read your book who might say that kind of sounds like a defeatist attitude where we really just need to give up trying to live at a healthy weight? What do you say? Because I know you get that all the time. Because you're just like, look, you know, the natural growth curve, whatever's natural for your child, give us that, you know, kind of give us a little insight on this whole thing and tie it in with this. Like, can the body nature intended be an obese one?
That's a good question. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot in the literature right now about that whole nature-nurture thing,
right.
You know, the gene-environment interaction.
Right.
And certainly, you know, earlier I said, you know, my family has the genes for fatness, and I also said my kids aren't fat. And so I think that kind of sums up the dilemma right there, that as I watch kids grow and as I follow their tracking on the growth curve, I see, you know, children of overweight or even obese parents who grow very consistently and remain, you know, just track right along their given growth percentile as long as they are fed nicely. But if there's, you know, errors in feeding, if the, you know, the child is being exposed to too little structure or too much interference with his eating, then those children's weight accelerate off from what appears to be their normal growth curve. You know, probably the child's genes for fatness allows that acceleration, but it doesn't cause it. Do you
mm-hmm.
know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas, you know, parents without genes for fatness could be making the very same errors in feeding their children, and that child might have extreme food selectivity or food refusal or, you know, sort of show other feeding problems, but not have his weight accelerate in that way. But, of course, this is all speculative, and the thing that I do know, and you know, out of that, what I do know is that children who grow consistently along a particular percentile on their growth curve are doing excellently well, and children who have the genes for fatness can do that just as handily as the children who do not. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, you know, I think so, and I'm going to tie it right into this. You state that we parents should, one, feed well, two, trust the child to eat as much as he or she needs, mm-hmm. and three, let the child have the body that nature intended.
Amen.
Right, so let's say that, you know, by some miracle, you've got the parent convinced and they're doing a really good job of letting the child truly do their division properly.
Mm-hmm.
They are really, truly not playing clever, cutesy games, and they're letting the child choose how much and whether they eat. And the child is obese and continues to follow along that obese path. What then? What's the advice, or what's the, for the people listening that are going, you know, I'm going to read three of Ellen's books, and I'm going to do it all just right. And matter of fact, I'm going to consult with her, and I'm going to do this and that, and I'm going to be the perfect parent, and I'm not going to play cute games, and I'm not going to have any fear in my child, and I'm going to do all this. And I'll tell you what, I let he or she eat as much as he or she wants, and they eat a ton.
Uh-huh.
What then?
What do you mean by obese?
I guess I would say by scientific definition, you know, BMI or whatever you want to go by.
Well, that's another trap, you know. Because I've seen children grow consistently above this policy
right.
stated cutoff point, which is 95th percentile BMI.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen children grow at the 97th. I've seen them grow above the 97th. In fact, my son was plodding along above the 97th when he was 3 or 4 years old,
mm-hmm.
Before his weight sort of started to drift down. And, you know, and I see them grow consistently. So I don't call those kids obese. If a child is growing consistently, I don't think there's a problem. Even if the weight tracks at a, level that is above this, you know, this cutoff point that we're hearing so much about. It's only when a child's weight accelerates, and that is climbs across growth percentiles, or, you know, diverges upward from what has appeared to be his or her normal growth pattern, that I get concerned about it. And at that point, even if the parent feels like they are doing an excellent job of feeding, I'd have to take a close look at it and see if I can get to the bottom of it and figure out what is disrupting that child's ability to grow consistently.
What,
and then correct that and then get that consistent growth back on track again.
One of the things I got from your book, and just tell me if I picked this right out of the book, is you are more concerned about an acceleration.
Exactly.
Than you are about a high percentile natural growth curve for the kid.
That's right. I am not at all concerned about a high percentile growth for the kid as long as it's consistent.
It's that acceleration that kind of makes you go, whoa, wait a minute.
That's right. And if a child's growing at the fifth percentile and accelerates to the 50th, then I wonder what's going on. Or at the 50th to the 80th, then I say, whoop, you know, what's happening here? Is this natural?
Well, that's great. And as I move on to the next subject, I think that you'll say another amen when I say that you said, today's crisis is not one of child overweight. It is a crisis of parenting and feeding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great segue to leave that topic. But yeah, I think that's great. And it was another kind of a paradigm shift for me as well.
Yeah.
And it will be for many of the listeners. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you, as we're getting close to the time here, let me have you, if you would, tell us your rules for food selection. I know for me, it was odd to read your take on how to choose foods because you want to be cute and clever and smart. And choose foods you like. Be knowledgeable and reliable about providing for your family, period. That was it. I was like, wait a minute, I like caramel ice cream, and I like hamburgers, and I like french fries, and I like healthy foods too.
Yeah,
I like a variety of foods.
Good for you.
Right. But it was choose foods you like, be knowledgeable and reliable about providing for your family. And I just wanted to ask you, how do we really embrace that and make that a practical part of our lives? Because we, as parents, want to provide, you know, healthier choices for our kids.
Exactly.
So what do we do?
Well, my rule for myself and the rules that I teach other nutrition professionals is you always have to join with families right where they are. Now, joining with you would be easy for a dietitian, probably, because you are interested in a variety of food and you plan meals with a variety of food, et cetera, et cetera. And so in working with you, we might have to encourage you to lighten up a little if you are having really low-fat meals or getting all excited about getting your children to eat vegetables. Whereas somebody who was, regularly eating at a fast food place or ordering pizza or having, you know, Pop-Tarts for breakfast regularly, if that, you know, kind of cruising, then we'd have to talk with them about, well, why not organize all that into structure? You know, why not have structured meals and eat all the food that you're eating right now, except make sure that you have structure. And that, and once the family gets the structure in place, and, you know, parents need to remind themselves of this as well as we reminding ourselves as professionals of this, that once the structure is in place, then the family can start to sneak up on greater variety and sneak up on the foods that they have learned are healthier. But if they expect too much of themselves too soon, and if they say, oh my gosh, we're going to have meals and it has to be, you know, broiled chicken and, you know, fat-free noodles and broccoli and all this, well, it's going to just act as a huge deterrent, and, you know, it's just too hard. But if people are willing to start where they are and expect that they'll gradually progress from there, then they're going to be able to do it.
And you say how you feed is more important than what you feed.
Exactly. And the how is the structure.
Right.
How is trusting the child? How is being reliable and having a good time with your kid at mealtime?
And that's the thing that I kind of want to kind of close up here with is at the mealtime, this is not the time to chew them out about their grades, right?
Exactly.
Is this the time to tell them they did a bad job mowing the lawn?
No, this is the time to say, how was your day? What did you learn today? How's your friend? I have this pleasant social time.
Because they need to think of that mealtime as just a very pleasant, calm, unstressful event that they can trust and rely on that their parents are going to provide.
Exactly. And, you know, we've been talking about child overweight, but the importance of the family meal goes so far beyond just nourishing children physically and preventing child overweight, because kids who have family meals, and these are studies with adolescents, do better in all ways. They do better socially, emotionally, academically. They do better with respect to resistance of drugs and alcohol and early sexual behaviors. Family meals have more to do with positive outcomes for children than anything else. Extracurricular activities, tutors, fine schools, music lessons, you name it. It's the family, the parents making that time with their child the priority, and having giving the child the reassurance that he's going to have reliable access to his parents' undivided attention, that makes the difference.
That is awesome. And you say, I'll just quote you again as we close this, you say, "For all feeding problems, the solution is the same. Establish and maintain the division of responsibility in feeding." And I like that, because it's like, look, I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell you again, and I'm going to tell you one more time, for all feeding problems, the solution is the same. Maintain the division of responsibility. But I really like how you tied it together at the end there, what that meal should be like.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten, and I'm so glad you brought up, as I now remember it from the book, the point about how the kids that are raised in having that trust and that family mealtime, and it is what it's supposed to be, you say, are better at all things.
Yeah.
And that has a greater impact than, I think you said, what, tutors and all, and mm-hmm. so many other things
right.
that parents try to do to improve their kids' academic and social lives.
That's right. And you know that line that you quoted me about earlier, it's not a crisis of overweight, it's a crisis of parenting.
Right.
Well, to me, that's a broader issue. That's a community issue. It's a political issue. It's an economic issue that, as a society, rather than hounding parents to starve their children and try to keep them thin, why don't we as a community start saying, as a broader society, saying, look, what do we need to do to support parents so they can do this for their children, so they can be more reliably there, so they can have these family meals, so they don't have all these competing other things that are not as important. And if we, you know, if we take this broader view and think in terms of supporting parents and think in terms of family development, then we're going to be on the right track. Right now, we are not on the right track.
Well, the thing that comes to mind as you say that, and this is, again, one of the things that you won me over in the book on this, is that the bigger issue is not whether you're giving the kid broccoli or French fries. The bigger issue is, are you providing the role at home as a parent with the feeding environment properly? Because so many, as you said, so many families, they don't sit down and have even one meal a day together.
That's right.
And that whole, it was, you know what it was for me? It was, the family dynamics relationship was stressed so much in the book that I went, you know what? That is much more of a problem today. And that is creating a lot of the other things that we are seeing.
Exactly.
In our kids. And you say it much better in the book. People absolutely should get it and read it for themselves. And I just want to say that this was an awesome interview. I could keep you here for hours
asking
you questions.
I'm having fun talking with you as well. Thank you for calling and doing this. And, I'll look forward to getting the dispatch.
You bet. And I just want to ask you one thing. If people want your expert advice, guidance, counseling, and so forth, how should they get a hold of your company or you or what have you?
I have a website. It's www.ellensatter.com. That's ELLYN, S as in Sam, ATTER, all one word, ellensatter.com. And there's bunches of material on the website and also a contact us link, and so they can email me or call my 800 number.
And you actually, this was discussed in the bio, of course, but I mean, you travel the country speaking on this.
Yeah.
You're nationally recognized as an expert and all that kind of stuff, so I know you're extremely busy, but you're in, I believe, Madison, Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
Just so people have an idea of kind of where they would need to come if they're going to see you in person.
Mm-hmm.
And now they know where to get a hold of you from afar.
Good.
Any final pearl you want to leave with any listener who will hear this now or 5 years from now?
Well, my pearl is to remind parents how important they are to their children. You know, today's children are so darn sophisticated, and they act already, you know, by the time they're 6 or 7, they start to act like they don't need us. And certainly when they're in school, and by the time they get into high school, they're really acting like that. But don't be fooled. They really do need us. And, you know, this division of responsibility and feeding that I was talking about, once you get that going, when a child is a toddler, you should, and you're entitled to keep that going throughout the child's growing up years. And that children will say when their parents aren't listening, I really love it that my parents do this. It is so important to me. So
that's great.
Don't forget that part.
Well, thank you so much again, and I have really enjoyed this, and I'll make sure that you get copies of it and all that stuff, and we'll speak to you soon.
Great. Thank you.
You bet.
Bye now.
Bye now. Please make sure you are subscribed to the Club Lifestyle Podcast so you don't miss any of my podcasts in the future. More information about the Leanness Lifestyle, my products and services, and more can be found at www.leannesslifestyle.com. That's www.leannesslifestyle.com. Or simply look for Club Lifestyle in the iTunes podcast directory. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Next episode, I'll talk about how Club Lifestyle was really created, how it came into its own, and what I really do for members there. Until next time, remember, nothing tastes as good as living lean feels. And most of a great body transformation isn't hard, it just is.